high above Adam's prison. New creatures sweep up into satellite orbit and back down to the planet's surface, obeying the old first hungers, the primal commands. Look, listen, taste, touch, feel, say, join. They gossip to one another, these new species, exchanging discoveries, as living code has exchanged itself from the beginning. They begin to link up, to fuse together, to merge their cells and form small communities. There's no saying what they might become in 70 plus 70 years. And so, Nile gets out and sees the world. His children comb the earth tonight with one command. Absorb everything. Eat every scrap of data you can find. Sort and compare more measurements than all of humanity in all of history has yet managed. Soon enough, his learners will see across the planet. They'll watch the vast boreal forests from space and read the species-teeming tropics from eye level. They'll study rivers and measure what's in them. They'll collate the data of every wild creature ever tagged and map their wanderings. They'll read every sentence in every article that every field scientist ever published. They'll binge-watch every landscape that anyone has pointed a camera at. They'll listen to all the sounds of the streaming earth. They'll do what the genes of their ancestors shaped them to do, what all their forebears have ever done themselves. They'll speculate on what it takes to live and put those speculations to the test. Then they'll say what life wants from people and how it might use them. On a lead-gray afternoon in the brutal hinterlands upstate, an armored van brings Adam back to school. Psych 101. He who understands nothing about people except their innate confusion is driven through the triple-depth razor-mesh fences of his new digs for continuing education. A squat concrete observation tower stands to the left of the entrance, 3 times taller than his boyhood maple. Inside the perimeter, a jumble of slab-walled bunkers waits for him, like something his son might make out of all-gray Legos. Off in the distance, surrounded by more razor-wire moats, men in bright orange, his new nation, play basketball in the aggressive, aggrieved way his brother Emmett always did, trying to scream the ball into the hoop. These men will beat him senseless many times. Not for being a terrorist, but for siding with the enemies of human progress, for being a traitor to the race. The warden riding shotgun in the van turns to smile, watching Adam's face as they drive down the camera-lined chute of fences. Adam pictures Lois dragging little Charlie here for hour-long visits, once a month at first, then a couple of times a year if he's lucky. Adam watches his son grow up in time-lapse intervals. He sees himself listening greedily to the boy's staggered reports, hanging on every word. Maybe they'll become friends at last. Maybe little Charlie will explain banking to him. They pull up in the unload zone, just down from the setback-guarded entrance. The warden and driver extract him from the van and escort him through the detectors. Glass the thickness of a Bible, banks of monitors and electronically locked grates. Through the armored arch behind the checkpoint, a cell-subtended hallway disappears lengthwise down an optical illusion into forever. The years ahead will run beyond anything he can imagine. The die-offs and disasters will make Bronze Age plagues seem quaint. Prison may become a hideaway from the sentence outside. Of all the waiting terrors, the one he fears most is time. He does the math, calculates how many futures he'll have to live through second by second until his sentence ends. Futures where our ancestors vanish before we even name them. Futures where our robot descendants use us for fuel, or keep us in infinitely entertaining zoos as secured as the one Adam now checks into. Futures where humanity goes to its mass grave, swearing it's the only thing in creation that can talk. Vast, empty expanses with nothing to fill the hours, but remembering how he and a handful of green-souled friends tried to save the world. But of course, it's not the world that needs saving. Only the thing that people call by the same name. A man behind the impenetrable glass, in a crisp white shirt emblazoned with a civic emblem, asks him for something. Name, maybe. Serial number. Apology. Adam frowns, distracted, elsewhere. He looks down. There's something on the cuff of his neon jumpsuit. Round, small, brown, a little globe covered with sticky burrs. He has come directly from one bleak brick holding facility, been pressed into a van, driven and unloaded straight into this wasteland of cut stone and concrete. There was not the slightest chance for such life to exploit him. But here he is, carrying this free rider. So it turned out for him, for all five of them, all of blinkered humankind, used by life as surely as this burr uses his jumpsuit cuff. And in that moment, it starts up, the quiet torture, worse than anything the state can inflict on Adam. A small voice, so real it might come from the bunk above him, whispers the start of a story that will plague him for longer than his imprisonment. You have been spared from death to do a most important thing. Across the biomes, at all altitudes, the learners come alive at last. They discover why a hawthorn never rots. They learn to tell apart the 100 kinds of oak, when and why the green ash split off from the white, how many generations live inside the hollow of a yew, when red maples start to turn at each elevation, and how much sooner they're turning every year. They will come to think like rivers and forests and mountains. They will grasp how a leaf of grass encodes the journey work of the stars. In a few short seasons, simply by placing billions of pages of data side by side, the next new species will learn to translate between any human language and the language of green things. The translations will be rough at first, like a child's first guess, but soon the first sentences will start to come across, pouring out words made, like all living things, from rain and air and crumbled rock and light. Hello. Finally. Yes. Here. It's us. Nile thinks, this is how it must go. There will be catastrophes, disastrous setbacks and slaughters. But life is going someplace. It wants to know itself. It wants the power of choice. It wants solutions to problems that nothing alive yet knows how to solve, and it's willing to use even death to find them. He will not live to see it completed, this game played by countless people worldwide, a game that puts the players smack in the middle of a living, breathing planet filled with potential they can only dimly begin to imagine. But he has nudged it along. He lifts his hands from the translating keys, hit by a radical amazement. His heart is beating too hard for what little meat is left on his skeleton, and his vision pulses. He pushes the joystick on the chair and rolls out of the lab into the mild night. The air is spiced with bay laurel and lemon eucalyptus and pepper trees. The scent retrieves all kinds of things he once knew, and reminds him of all those things he never will. He breathes in for a long time. Phenomenal, to be such a small, weak, short-lived being on a planet with billions of years left to run. The branches click in the dark, dry air above his head, and he hears them. Now, Nileji, what might this little creature do? A moan comes out of Ray when Dorothy tells him how things end. Two life sentences, back to back. Too severe for arson, for destruction of public and private properties, even for involuntary manslaughter. But just harsh enough for that unforgivable crime, harming the safety and certainty of men. They lie against each other in his bed, looking out through the window on that place that they've discovered just alongside this one, the place where the story came from. Outside, hidden in branches, an owl calls its kin. Who cooks for you all? Who cooks for you? Tomorrow the city landscapers will come again and bring with them machines and all the irresistible force of law. And still, that won't be the end of the story. Brinkman chokes on objections. A word comes up and out of his throat.
No, not right.
His wife shrugs, her shoulder nudging his. The shrug is not without sympathy, though it doesn't apologize. It just says, make your case. His objections cascade into something wider. Tides of blood rise through his brain.
Self-defense.
She turns on her side to face him. He has her attention. Her hands move a little in the air, as if punching the narrow, corded keyboard of her old stenotype. How? He tells her with his eyes. The one-time property lawyer must take over the defense's appeal. He's at a severe disadvantage. He knows none of the particulars. He has seen none of the evidence produced in discovery. He has no court experience to speak of, and criminal law was always his worst subject. But the argument he lays out before the jury is as clear as a row of Lombardy poplars. In silence, he walks his lifelong partner through old and central principles of jurisprudence, one syllable at a time. Stand your ground. The Castle Doctrine. Self-help. If you could save yourself, your wife, your child, or even a stranger by burning something down, the law allows you. If someone breaks into your home and starts destroying it, you may stop them however you need to. His few syllables are mangled and worthless. She shakes her head. I can't get you, Ray. Say it some other way. He can find no way to say what so badly needs saying. Our home has been broken into. Our lives are being endangered. The law allows for all necessary force against unlawful and imminent harm. His face turns the color of sunset, scaring her. Her arm goes out to calm him. No worries, Ray. It's just words. Everything's fine. In mounting excitement, he sees how he must win the case. Life will cook. The seas will rise, the planet's lungs will be ripped out, and the law will let this happen because harm was never imminent enough. Imminent, at the speed of people, is too late. The law must judge imminent at the speed of trees. At that thought, the vessels in his brain give way, the way that earth does when roots no longer hold it together. The flood of blood brings a revelation. He lifts his eyes to the window, to the mysterious outside. There, two life sentences pass in a few heartbeats. The seedlings race upward toward the sun. The varied trunks thicken, shed, fall, and rise again. Their branches rush to enclose the house and punch through its windows. At the stand's center, the chestnut folds and unfolds, girthing out, spiraling upward, patting the air for new paths, new places, further possibilities. Great-rooted blossomer. Ray? Dorothy's arms reach out to keep him from convulsing. Ray! She's on her feet, knocking the stacks of books on the bedside table to the floor. But in another moment, another look, emergency turns into its opposite. Her throat clamps shut and her eyes sting, as if the air were full of pollen. She thinks, how can it happen now? We still had books to read. There was something the two of us were supposed to do. We were just beginning to understand each other. At her feet, on the floor, is The New Metamorphosis by the author of The Secret Forest. It was on the top of the pile of read-alouds, waiting for the readers who'll never get to read it. The Greeks had a word, xenia, guest friendship, a command to take care of traveling strangers, to open your door to whoever is out there, because anyone passing by, far from home, might be God. Ovid tells the story of two immortals who came to Earth in disguise to cleanse the sickened world. No one would let them in, but one old couple, Baucis and Philemon. And their reward for opening their door to strangers was to live on after death as trees, an oak and a linden, huge and gracious and intertwined. What we care for, we will grow to resemble, and what we resemble will hold us when we are us no longer. Dorothy touches the corpse's bewildered face. Already it has started to soften, even as it grows cold. Ray, she says, I'll be right there. Not fast enough at the speed of her own need, but at the speed of trees, very soon. Darkness settles in. Mission Dolores Park's inhabitants change, as do their purposes. But even these night visitors cut a path around Mimi. She leans forward, hands in her lap like two tender figs. She bows her head, weighed down by liberty. The lights blaze in front of her. The skyline turns into sublime allegory. She dozes and wakes many times. Her left hand starts up again, tugging at the ring finger of her right. She's like a dog unable to stop gnawing at its own foot. But this time, it yields. The jade band slips over her age-swollen knuckle and pops free. A weight flies up and out of her, and she cracks open. She sets the green circle in the grass, the one round thing amid a bedlam of growth and splitting. She leans back again against the pine's trunk. Some slight change in the atmosphere, the humidity, and her mind becomes a greener thing. At midnight, on this hillside, perched in the dark above this city, with her pine standing in for a bow, Mimi gets enlightened. The fear of suffering that is her birthright, the frantic need to steer, blows away on the wind. And something else wings down to replace it. Messages hum from out of the bark she leans against. Chemical semaphores home in over the air. Currents rise from the soil-gripping roots, relayed over great distances through fungal synapses linked up in a network the size of the planet. The signals say, a good answer is worth reinventing from scratch again and again. They say, the air is a mix we must keep making. They say, there's as much below ground as above. They tell her, do not hope or despair or predict or be caught surprised. Never capitulate, but divide, multiply, transform, conjoin, do, and endure as you have all the long day of life. There are seeds that need fire, seeds that need freezing, seeds that need to be swallowed, etched in digestive acid, expelled as waste, seeds that must be smashed open before they'll germinate. A thing can travel everywhere just by holding still. She sees and hears this by direct gathering through her limbs. The fires will come despite all efforts, the blight and windthrow and floods. Then the earth will become another thing, and people will learn it all over again. The vaults of seed banks will be thrown open. Second growth will rush back in, supple, loud, and testing all possibilities. Webs of forest will swell with species shot through in shadow and dappled by new design. Each streak of color on the carpeted earth will rebuild its pollinators. Fish will surge again up all the watersheds, stacking themselves as thick as cordwood through the rivers, thousands per mile. Once the real world ends. The next day dawns. The sun rises so slowly that even the birds forget there was ever anything else but dawn. People drift back through the park on their way to jobs, appointments, and other urgencies. Making a living. Some pass within a few feet of the altered woman. Mimi comes too and speaks her very first Buddha's words. I'm hungry. The answer comes from right above her head. Be hungry. I'm thirsty. Be thirsty. I hurt. Be still and feel. She lifts her eyes onto a trouser cuff of blackish blue. She follows the blue upward along the creases, past the belt with its radio and cuffs and gun and oak baton, up the blue-black pressed shirt and badge, and on to the face. A man, a boy, a blood relation, whose eyes find hers. The man stares back at her, alerted by what he has just seen. An old woman talking to a thing whose answers are all mute, wooden, and spreading. Are you all right? She tries to move, but can't. Her voice won't work. Her limbs stiffen. Only her fingers can wave a little. She holds the man's gaze, open to every charge. Guilty, her eyes say. Innocent. Wrong. Right. Alive. The man in the red plaid coat comes back the next day, accompanied by two strapping 20-year-old twins in sheepskin and a giant man with a raven profile and the girth of a middle linebacker. They pack in a hefty gas chainsaw, two small dollies, and another block and tackle. That's the scary thing about men. Get a few together with some simple machines, and they'll move the world. The ad hoc crew works for many hours, reading each other with little need for words. Together they drag the last carcasses of pine and spruce, pain-killing willow and astringent birch, into place. Then they stand in silence and regard the design they've laid out across the forest floor. The shape arrests them. It reads them their rights. You have a right to be present, a right to attend, a right to be astonished. The man in plaid stands with his arms at his side and gazes on the message the five of them have just written. It's good, he says, and his boys agree by saying nothing. Nick stands next to them, leaning on a staff of spruce, the kind of thing that might spring into bloom if you plunged it into the ground. His friends begin to chant in a very old language. It strikes Nick as strange how few languages he understands. 1.5 human ones, not a single word of all the other living, speaking things. But what these men chant, Nick half grasps, and when the songs are finished, he adds, Amen, if only because it may be the single oldest word he knows. The older the word, the more likely it is to be both useful and true. In fact, he read once back in Iowa, the night the woman came to trouble him into life, that the word tree and the word truth come from the same root. The transported pieces of downed wood snake through the standing trees. Satellites high up above this work already take pictures from orbit. The shapes turn into letters complete with tendril flourishes, and the letters spell out a gigantic word legible from space. Still. The learners will puzzle over the message that springs up there, so near to the methane-belching tundra. But in the blink of a human eye, the learners will grow connections. Already, this word is greening. Already, the mosses surge over, the beetles and lichen and fungi turning the logs to soil. Already, seedlings root in the nurse log's crevices, nourished by the rot. Soon, new trunks will form the word in their growing wood, following the cursive of these decaying mounds. 2 centuries more, and these 5 living letters, too, will fade back into the swirling patterns, the changing rain and air and light. And yet, but still, they'll spell out for a while the word life has been saying since the beginning. I'll be getting back now, Nick says.
Back where?
Good question. He stares off into the north woods, where the next project beckons. Branches combing the sun, laughing at gravity, still unfolding. Something moves at the base of the motionless trunks. Nothing. Now everything. This, a voice whispers from very nearby. This, what we have been given, what we must earn. This will never end. The End. This book was read for you by Suzanne Torin, a member of SAG-AFTRA. We hope you've enjoyed this production of The Overstory by Richard Powers. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold, including Audible.com, Audiobooks.com, Apple iTunes, and in public libraries through RB Digital. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.